Welcome to NHL at the Rink. Dan Rosen here. As always, to my right, Sean Rourke. Sean, how's everything going?
Great. Time to pack. St. Louis tomorrow for All-Star Game. Nice early flight. 4 days there. We haven't been there since the Stanley Cup Final. Weather will be a little different, but going to be a great time.
Yeah, not exactly the sunshine destination for an All-Star weekend, but the hockey fans are going to be loving it. And, you know, the Stanley Cup is going to be there. And the Stanley Cup champions play there. So there's a lot going on in St. Louis this coming weekend.
There's going to be a little bit of snow. It's going to be hockey weather. It's going to be great.
It is. And you know what's going on right now, which I find fascinating? I've been waiting for it, is the all-decade stuff that's being released right now on NHL.com. And, you know, you've got franchise, coach, game, save, number of different all-decade moments, event of the decade. And Friday night on NBCSN, the first and second teams of the all-decade teams will be released as well as part of the skills competition broadcast. Before we get to that, the thing that caught my attention, Sean, and I think it did catch yours, was the game of the decade.
Yeah, well, the thing I like about the all-decade team is the unity that it engenders as everybody reads it and agrees with our picks. And says,
that's right.
Of course, that's what it is. But so the game of the decade was the Toronto Maple Leafs and the Boston Bruins. The Bruins coming back from 3 goals down in the first round to beat the Leafs. Great game. Set up
terrific
a great
game.
A great part of Bruins history.
Not the game of the decade.
Chicago, L.A.,
yeah,
Game 7.
I agree.
2014.
You got me.
That was the series of the decade, hands down. Games 5 through 7, some of the best hockey I've ever seen in the 40 years I've been watching hockey critically. And Game 7, ridiculous.
I just remember I wasn't covering that game. I was watching it from home. I had covered the Rangers-Montreal series that year. And so you're just waiting to see where you're going, basically, and the emotion, and that's just from a personal standpoint, like, where am I going tomorrow? You don't know. Is it Chicago? Is it L.A.? So, and I just remember that wave of emotion from a personal, all right, I'm going to Chicago. Oh, wait, no, we're going to L.A. Oh, wait, back to Chicago. And then Jonathan Quick, which is an, you know, underrated moment of this game, I think, he makes a save on a rush by the Blackhawks with about 5 or 6 seconds left where he, if you just look at the overhead view of that save left in regulation, he's in a full split, and it's a 4-4 game at that point. And that could have been it right there, a last-second goal to go to the Stanley Cup Final in Game 7, but it wasn't. And then overtime happens, and Alec Martinez, of all people, in a series that, you know, you have all this star power and these cup champions, you got Alec Martinez, a defenseman, putting a shot in off of Nick Leddy, now with the Islanders, then with the Blackhawks, beats Corey Crawford, sends the Kings into the Stanley Cup Final. I think it's the game of the decade. I think it had everything you wanted: physicality, skill, emotion. The crowd was nuts. I thought it was just had everything going on, and I was watching that from my couch.
Yeah, no, it was ridiculous. I'll always remember Corey Crawford when that goal went in, kind of bounced over his shoulder, down on one knee. You could see the crest of his helmet with the Blackhawk. He was almost genuflecting, just crushed. The other thing I'll remember is the defenseman in that series. Huge minutes.
Yeah.
Keith and Doughty. 32 minutes. Doughty played 32 minutes in one game. Keith played 32 minutes in Game 7. It was a ridiculous display of two of the defensemen of the decade at their prime. You could argue that was the very peak of their powers.
Yeah, and we'll see again if they'll be on the all-decade teams released Friday night on NBCSN. And you know, look, the franchise of the decade, the Blackhawks. I don't think there is an argument against that, but maybe you could make a case for the Pittsburgh Penguins, who won the Stanley Cup twice and were the last Stanley Cup champion in the previous decade and never missed the playoffs.
Yeah, I think they were the most consistent team. Every year they were there. Every year they won games. Chicago a little up and down, but their peaks were ridiculous. And some of the years that they were out, they played. Look, they had to butt heads with L.A. at their prime. They had to butt heads with Nashville on its way up. So they had some tough roads. The other team, I think the three most winning teams of that decade were Boston, Pittsburgh, and the Blackhawks, just in wins.
Yeah.
And look, if the Blackhawks don't beat the Bruins in Game 6 of that Stanley Cup Final with the two goals in the last minute, you'd be talking maybe about the Bruins being the team of the decade.
Yeah, it's certainly possible, and that was another one that could have gone down as a game of the decade too, the way, especially, you know, with the way that finished. And we were talking about it before we started recording. Coach of the decade, Joel Quenneville, I think is a runaway, but I guess you could make the case for one other, right? And you were talking about Barry Trotz.
Yeah, just in what he did, you know, taking Nashville from being a Midland team to being a very good team before he left, and then going to Washington, winning a cup there, ending that drought, and then coming to New York and taking a team that couldn't make the playoffs to a team that knocked off the Pittsburgh Penguins and made it to the second round of the playoffs and is one of the lead teams again in the yeah. first half of this season. I think he's a fantastic coach. He just doesn't have the hardware that Q has.
No, one Stanley Cup, you give him a ton of credit for it, but Quenville's got three, and he's back in Chicago, by the way, with the Panthers to play. We're recording this Tuesday, so they'll be they're playing Tuesday night. But let's get to some current events in the NHL. We touched on the all decade, but the Columbus Blue Jackets rolling right now, hottest team in the league. They won't be in the all decade discussion at all, but maybe they will be in 2029. We'll say 2030. We'll see. 15-2-4 since December 9th, and that's when they beat the Capitals 5-2. I saw them at Madison Square Garden the other night, Sunday night, and they scored two in the third, one with 26 seconds to go to win the game 2-1. Nothing fancy, but just a team, Sean, that really understands its identity and plays to it and is honest in its assessments when it's not playing to an identity as well. And I think because of that, this team's for real.
Well, you just described John Tortorella.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the mindset. I also think this team has a chip on its shoulder. All they heard about all summer was everybody that they lost, Bobrovsky, Panarin, and oh my God, how can they ever survive this? There were 18 other guys on that team. It was a pretty good hockey team, and I think a lot of them have embraced that and said, well, we'll show you. And then, look, since I've been doing this podcast, every time we talk about a team, good or bad, well, what about the goalie?
Yeah,
Elvis has been unbelievable. He's been the guy who's carried them, and it didn't look like that way early on. Everybody thought he was kind of a bust after all the excitement about him coming into the league. He's found his groove, and Columbus has fed off of it.
Look, he's 4-0-0 with three shutouts and a .50 goals against, .985 save percentage in his past four starts. When Corpusello went down, I thought, oh boy, the Blue Jackets, this guy had no wins. He's 8-2, .955 save percentage, and a .51 goals against since Corpusello went down. He's been terrific. It was interesting. I was talking to Jody Shelley, who's on their broadcast for Fox Sports Ohio, former player, and he said if his name was Rob instead of Elvis, he might not have as much of a following as he's developing, but his name is Elvis. He's got a lot of swagger, a ton of confidence, and the guys, and I talked to Seth Jones about this, I talked to Zach Werenski about this, and we can ask Nick Foligno about this. Nick Foligno, the captain of the Blue Jackets, will be our first guest on here in a couple of minutes on this show. They love playing in front of this guy because of his confidence. They believe he's going to they know that he believes he's going to make every save, and that helps them.
I think he needed this, right? When you're a young goalie, you need repetition. And the way it was set up, he was clearly the number two, especially because he struggled out of the gate. He got sent to the minors at one point. He was in Cleveland. He needs to play a lot of games, and he needed to get his confidence because his game is entirely confidence. I remember talking to him in Traverse City. He played in the rookie tournament to start the year. And you know, full of swagger. He wanted to see what the NHL was about, what the smaller ice was about. He played in Europe, so a little bit of a different game. But you know what? He's so dedicated. I remember talking to their goalie coach, spent a lot of time with him in the summer. Elvis had moved here, and he introduced him to golf.
Mm-hmm.
And now Elvis plays golf every chance he gets because he just wants to master the game. And he's completely fanatical about it. He plays in all kinds of weather. He's just got that mind, right? That elite athlete mind where you give them a challenge and they're just going to sit there and they're going to ruminate on it and they're going to be repetitious about it until they figure out how to solve whatever is stymieing them from being what they think they can be. And I think that's what he's done here with his goaltending.
He's become so big, we haven't even mentioned his last name yet. We're just going by Elvis. Elvis Merzlikins, and we'll get a chance right now to ask our first guest about him and the Blue Jackets in general, the captain of the Blue Jackets, Nick Foligno. Nick, thank you so much for joining us. How's everything today?
Very well. How are you guys doing?
Doing good. So I got to ask you, here you were, the Blue Jackets, 11-14-4 after losing 4-1 at Florida on December 7th. People were sort of thinking, okay, that's what the Blue Jackets are. 15-2-4 since. What's been the spark? How have you guys turned this around?
You know what I think it was? It was a lot of different guys struggling at the start of the year. And I think, unfortunately, when we had all the injuries, it kind of banded us together. And you know, now you're not thinking about the struggles. You're thinking about how are we going to survive? You know, how are we going to get through this? How are we going to, find a way and staying afloat? And, you know, I think we just became a really good team. I think the guys that came up really helped spark us. But I think also the room kind of, you know, the guys that were there that were left of all the injuries were kind of like, okay, let's band together. Let's figure out a way to help these guys succeed and help ourselves. And you saw our team defense really come to life. And then our goalies played outstanding. And I think when you have that mix of timely goals and a team mindset, I mean, I think it shows anything's possible. And we've been big believers in that. And it's made it a lot of fun in our room.
We were joking in the intro to you coming on that your goalie has been so good that he goes by one name now. We don't even need to know his last name because it's too difficult to pronunciate anyways. But look, you've played in front of a good goalie before this. You've played against some good goalies in the past. What makes Elvis different?
I don't know. I think with Elvis, he's a strong personality. I mean, if you watch him, he wears the shiny stuff, and he's a really good person. He's talkative. He's not your typical goalie that likes to be left alone. I think he likes the limelight. But I think he's learned in this league that you can't go chase it. You know, you have to let it come to you. And, you know, early on in the season, I think he was trying to find, you know, make his statement of I'm here and I'm playing well. And it didn't quite get off the gate. So now I think with the opportunity he got with Corpy going down, he's just, you know, allowed himself just to kind of to let it come to him. And now he's starting to get all these accolades because he's talented. I mean, we could see that. That was never the issue. It's just, I think all the other stuff, it's such a grind, NHL. You know, just when you think you figured it out, things switch. And I think he's learning that at a pretty quick rate. If this is his first year playing in North America. So I give him a lot of credit and really being a huge part of why we've had success, but also, you know, him finding his game and allowing us to have the confidence in front of him. And it's been a lot of fun. I think with Corpy going down, we love playing in front of him, and now we're really in love and playing in front of Elvis. And it's helped our team tremendously.
Did his personality, Nick, take you aback when you first met him, when you first, you know, saw him come in? It was last year, even last season. Did it take you aback, and were you wondering, like, is this guy going to kind of adhere here to what we do here in the NHL?
No, I'm all for guys having strong personalities. I think it's fun. I think, you know, everyone's only times it's only robots, and it's fun when you have a different personality. But my biggest concern is, as always, how does it fit with our team? How does it fit? Does he understand that it's about us, not him? And I think he has. I think, you know, it's learning at a young age. I think when he was over in Switzerland, it's a lot of things, talks was about Elvis Merzlikins and the team. Now it's, you know, he's part of the Blue Jackets. And he realizes, I think, too, in the NHL now, the accolades come. You know, when you have team success, they're talking about you. And rightfully so. He's done an outstanding job. And a lot of guys on our team have. It's not just Elvis. I think he realizes that too, that there's a lot of guys going that go around to have success in this league. And I'm really proud of him that he's just humbled himself and taken this and run with it, because, you know, we're thrilled for him. We love playing in front of him. We love playing in front of all our goalies. It was unfortunate seeing Corpy go down because he was having, well, he has an all-star season so far. So we're pretty fortunate to have these great goaltenders in our system. And Manny Legacy has done an outstanding job with them. We're having fun right now.
You talked about it's been a lot of guys. Obviously, the storyline coming into this year was the guys that you lost and who was going to replace them. And that's kind of happened organically. There hasn't been anybody brought in that's kind of given you that jolt. Guys have developed more that have been there. You know, Pierre-Luc Dubois would be one. Did you kind of feel that these guys could right away do it? I know you talked about the injuries kind of slowing things down a little bit, but did you feel coming into camp that this was the team that you had, the one you have right now?
I did, yeah. I knew that it was probably going to take a little while for everyone to understand how we needed to play. I think early on, actually, at the start of the year, we actually got out to a pretty good start, stumbled a little bit out the gates, but then got our game going. After about 10 games, I think we were right in the playoffs, and then, you know, then we started to kind of lose ourselves. I think what happens is you're so used to, you know, especially certain guys, when you have those players around, you're around the puck more, our team had to just change a little bit of our mindset. And it's hard to do. It's hard to do when you're used to getting certain looks and certain guys are used to scoring at a certain pace, and then it's not happening, right? There's some struggles, and so you start to think about yourself a little bit. And I kind of found our team was doing that, and then these injuries kind of brought us back into okay team mode again, you know. And it's amazing what that can do sometimes. And you don't want it to happen, but I think it brought our team back to what really matters and how we need to play. And we've taken off from there. You're seeing guys now. It's just a team effort. It's block shots. It's making the right plays at the right time. It's grinding games out and winning. And you know, we're winning in the last minute. And so it's really fun to be a part of that and have guys buy into that. Because when you have that buy-in, I mean, anything's possible.
I gotta ask you. I was taken. I guess not taken aback because I know John Tortorella and what he can say. But you guys beat the New Jersey Devils 5-0, and after that game, this was Saturday, after that game, he used words like it was embarrassing and we sucked, and yet you won 5-0. What's your takeaway when Torts is talking like that, and is that part of the honest assessment that the team has in itself, in its play, even in a 5-0 win?
Yeah, I mean, I think that just shows the growth and the standard around the Columbus Blue Jackets, you know, and I think we're proud of that. Obviously, we'll take the win. I think you'll take any result, and it's a positive one, but knowing that, you know, in order to have success consistently, you have to have a better effort than what we did. We just, you know, our game was slipping a little bit in the aspects that we were really good in for the past 10 or so games, where our defensive game was right there, and we seemed to be relying too much on our goalie and too much on our, you know, our defensive play, and our trying to, you know, offense was starting to come a little bit more, so we started to cheat a little bit and not play the right style, and he's going to call us on that. That's what makes him a great coach, and why we've had the success we've had this year is because we've bought into that and understood who we are, and he wanted to remind us of that. And I thought we had a great answer game in New York, you know, finding a way against a really high-powered team to come back and answer and play the right way, and another great opportunity before the break here against Winnipeg.
What's it like as a forward playing with the safety net of Seth Jones and Werenski behind you?
Yeah, you take for granted sometimes how good RD is. Not just those guys. I mean, I know they're exceptional players and will be all-stars and Norris Trophy winners. But our whole decor in general is just so solid, you know, with even Savard and Gavrikov becoming more of a shutdown pair now for us and how good they are. And then, you know, even our third pairing, if you want to call it that, when it's got Ryan Murray healthy, and right now it's Nudavara and Harrington, and you know, we're pretty fortunate to have the D we have, and then to have those two kind of anchor it, you know, just the way they can take over a game, you know, with their speed, they can, you know, get up the ice and take advantage of other teams when you know, and it allows us to play that offensive game, allows us to get out of our end quick. And yeah, we're really fortunate and appreciative of what those guys bring, and I think they know that. I think, you know, we try to reciprocate as much as we can in the D zone to allow their offensive instincts to come out. But I think, you know, you're really seeing Zach Werenski, especially understanding his defensive, you know, play now, and he's become even better, which is pretty dangerous when you mix in his offensive instincts. And it's a lot of fun having those guys back there.
Nick, my takeaway from your team, and I was around you guys at the Garden the other night when you guys played the Rangers, is it's a team that is honest in its assessment of itself, but really truly understands its identity and how it needs to play, and that the chemistry is good. With that in mind, the trade deadline is approaching. We know Jarmo Kekalainen is not afraid to make a move, but is there any hesitancy because the team is going so well right now that you don't want to, you know, tinker here, that you don't want to, even if scoring might still be a concern, you guys are finding ways. You're a captain of this team. I mean, what's your read on the team with the trade deadline approaching and the potential that there could be, you know, a minor change here and there just to try to enhance the scoring a little?
Yeah, and you know what? It's funny because I've been asked that, and honestly, I have such a good relationship with Jarmo and such trust in him with what he's done and how he is, and he has such a good pulse of our room that I know that he'll only do something if it's going to make the team better. He's not a short-term guy. Even what he tried to do last year, he felt like that was the best opportunity to make us better, even going forward. And you know, I appreciate that about him. I think he's not just an impulse guy. He's a guy that really thinks about things and gives us a chance every time we step on the ice. And So I think if there's a deal to be made, I'm sure he's going to look at it and talk to us and get our feelings. But he knows how important chemistry is. And, you know, I think our team is showing that we have the abilities. But obviously we'd love for any time you can, you know, add a player that's going to make a difference in your team. I think with the way we're structured and our group and our leadership and our room, we'll embrace that player and make sure they're helping us. So I'm glad I'm not making those decisions, but I'm glad we're in a position to be talking about adding and hopefully, you know, going the distance. So I'm really proud of this group and how we've banded together and found a way to become a real good team.
We're going to switch gears a little bit. You just spoke about teams. For the past week, the NHL has been doing their all-decade stuff. Goal, coach, a lot of them have been pretty obvious. You know, Q is the coach in Chicago would be an almost no-brainer. I'm curious, having played through much of the decade and obviously being a huge hockey fan, who's your team of the decade?
It's funny because, you know, I don't play the Chicago Blackhawks very much. I know they were picked. So, you know, for me, it would probably be the Pittsburgh Penguins only because that team just seemed to be the one to beat all the time. Even, you know, you could even go back earlier and you know, the cups they were winning, and they always seemed to be in the mix. So I know Chicago won, was three in the decade.
Yeah.
So, and what Pittsburgh, what did they get?
Two. They got two, and they won the last one before the decade changed.
Yeah. So, you know, to me, that's just that they're always the team that I had to go through in the playoffs. I played them, I don't even know, five or six times in the playoffs. And, players that they have on that team, and they've been an elite team for a long time, and they continue to be, it seems like, even with injuries and the way they're built. So I hate giving them a lot of credit because I love battling them, and, but yeah, they've been a team that, for me, just playing against them so many times, their consistency always seems to be there.
Yeah, and the way they were able to handle it without Sidney Crosby this year, and obviously not just stay in the race but rise up those standings is impressive. What do you take? Like, look at the Metropolitan Division standings and how tight things are. What's your take as a guy who's right in the thick of it on this division?
Yeah, I mean, it's I'd love to go to some other division sometimes just to see what would it be like. With the way the Metro seems to play out every year, it's anyone's game right to the end. But it's, you know, it makes it fun, too. I mean, every game is so important. And it's I think you're proud to be in the middle or in the pack, in the mix, because you know your team's good. You know you're competing on a nightly basis against all these teams. It ticks you off when you win and you see that, you know, half your division's won a game as well. But at the end of the day, it's I'm sure the league loves it. But it's, yeah, it's frustrating sometimes with looking around and seeing where other teams are in the standings and other divisions and where your team could be. But we're just going to keep grinding, keep our heads down, and hope we're right in the mix come April.
There's the captain of the Blue Jackets with some of his thoughts on the team. Like we said, 15-2-4, Sean, since December 9th. They have one more game before the break against the Winnipeg Jets on Wednesday. And I asked them about it, and I think it's interesting. What do they do with the deadline approaching, right? I mean, this is an interesting time for Jarmo Kekalainen with a team that's got a lot of chemistry and is playing well. There's a balancing act here of how do you add, even though their scoring is down and they may need a pop of offense.
They do need a pop of offense, and I don't care how good your chemistry is. Once you get to the playoffs, everybody's going to play defense, and you need a game breaker.
They don't have that.
Who's their game breaker?
They don't have it.
Their leading scorer is Dubois. He has 35 points. The teams that have a leading scorer with less than 35 points are all out of the playoffs, except for Arizona, who also has 35.
And Taylor Hall would have more if he was there all year.
It's Anaheim, New Jersey, and Ottawa.
Yeah. No, look, they probably do need a scoring pop. It's interesting that they've been able to do this and piece this together with the injuries they've had and losing Panarin in the offseason. He went to the New York Rangers, obviously. But I think, look, last year, Jarmo Kekalainen added at the deadline. He went all in, got Duchesne, got Dzingel, kept Panarin, kept Bobrovsky, because he knew Panarin and Bobrovsky were probably gone, and this is my last shot to try to win with them. And look, they went and they swept the Tampa Bay Lightning. They did something a Blue Jackets team had never done before, which is advance to the second round. Expectations were higher. This year, expectations were not high, and yet here they are right in the thick of the race with a team that's clearly gelled together. I get the point that they probably do need scoring. I just think you have to be careful on what you add here because you're going to be displacing something that's working for this team, and that you don't want to ruffle any feathers with that either.
No, and he doesn't have the ammunition that he had. There's no UFAs on this team to deal with. He's got both goalies are going to be RFAs, but that's about it as far as decision. But he also doesn't have draft capital. No second round pick, no third round pick this year, no second round pick next year. All part of the ransom and trying to make the team better last year. So even if he wants to do something, it becomes inherently more difficult because he's squandered a lot of his trade chips.
Yeah, absolutely. So that'll be interesting to see what they do as a lead up to the deadline. Also, staying in the division, the Carolina Hurricanes. Look, Justin Williams is back, so that answers a little bit of their depth up front. But Dougie Hamilton could be out for the rest of the season with his leg injury, and now that creates a big hole on their back end. He's been having a season worthy of Norris Trophy consideration. So Don Waddell is up now, and he's probably going to have to solve something with this defense.
I guess. I mean, that's a pretty good defense. I would argue that that's one of the best four deep, maybe five deep defenses in the league.
Even without Dougie Hamilton on it?
No, with Dougie Hamilton. Yeah. So they're still four solid, right? I mean, the guys that they have there, Pesci, Slavin, those are good players. They're each going to have to take 3-4 minutes of what Hamilton's doing. Look, I'm not saying don't add, but what are you going to add that can replace Dougie Hamilton?
Well, you're not going to replace Dougie Hamilton's production. You're not going to replace probably his minutes that he plays, but you can add. I mean, look at some of the names who could be potential rentals. Brendan Dillon, Sammy Vatanen, Marco Scandella, Ron Hainsey, another one that Carolina knows well. Like, these aren't guys that are jumping off the page at you, but they're not going to cost you an arm and a leg either, and they're going to fill out your depth defensively. And if you want to go one further, Alec Martinez from the Los Angeles Kings, who appears to be available, he still has another year left on his contract too, so you get a little more cost certainty there as well. I just think with as tight, and we touched on it with Nick Foligno, with as tight as the Metro is, and Carolina in that mix with Pittsburgh and Washington and Columbus and the New York Islanders, and the Rangers want to, you know, creep up there as well, one extra defenseman could be the difference between making and missing the playoffs. It could come down to that.
I think what they need is Jake Gardner to be the Jake Gardner they thought they signed and not the Jake Gardner that's playing for him. But just as importantly is going to be Justin Williams and what impact he has on coming back to this team. You know, decides he's coming out of retirement, played his first game this week, 13 minutes and change, scores the shootout winner against the Islanders. You know, if he can give you what he gave you last year up front and you have that extra margin of one goal, you know, in most games, maybe that's enough. And their goaltending plays well enough.
Well, yeah, their goaltending, but it's still a question mark for me.
Yeah.
Their goaltending. There's question marks there with Carolina, but I just think if you're Don Waddell, Dougie Hamilton goes down, you can also use the long-term injured relief money. Not that they are necessarily up against it right now in terms of the cap, but Dougie Hamilton goes down, you use the LTIR relief, you go out and you get yourself another defenseman to fill out your depth, and if Dougie Hamilton's able to come back in April and play in the playoffs, wow, you're that much better for it.
Yeah. Well, simple.
Simple.
I'm sure he'll
just
go
ahead
and do
it. Yeah, just go ahead and do it. All right, let's move on. Our next guest is Kendall Coyne Schofield, and she's pretty much everywhere these days. She will be in St. Louis playing in the Elite Women's 3-on-3 presented by Adidas, playing for the U.S., the American All-Stars against the Canadian All-Stars in the women's game. It's going to be a very interesting part of the skills competition Friday. She's on the NHL Network. She's on the Sharks broadcast, and now she is on with us. Kendall, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Doing very well. I need to get your instant thought when you found out that the NHL wanted to do this 3-on-3 women's game as part of the skills competition in St. Louis. What was the instant reaction you had?
I was excited. I was excited to hear that 20 women would be involved and 20 women would be activated within the All-Star Weekend in St. Louis coming up. And, you know, more the merrier. And I know, you know, there's 20 elite women that are going to put on a show for the fans in St. Louis and the fans that are going to be watching.
More importantly, it's U.S. versus Canada. Are all your Canada rivals on the opposing team?
Yes, and that's the other factor. It's a huge rivalry. It's going to be intense. And, you know, sometimes the All-Star game can be fun. This is going to be fun, but at the end of the day, it's going to be intense because once you put on your nation's colors, all bets are off.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I mean, this has the makings of being the most serious thing at All-Star Weekend, right? The most serious competition.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of pride on the line, but I think, you know, collectively as 20 players, whether we're from the U.S. or from Canada, we know how important this moment is to showcase our sports. And so we take that very seriously, and we know we have to, you know, we have to play. We have to showcase our product because people don't always have the opportunity to see us on a regular basis like they do with their NHL All-Stars. So this is a unique opportunity that we need to really seize.
It's also a unique opportunity because it's 3-on-3, and while that's become highly popular in the NHL, you don't get to play that format a lot. I would assume there has to be an excitement with just having that format and how wide open it's going to be and the skills that are going to be shown.
That's honestly one of the most exciting parts about this. We don't play 3-on-3. We haven't. The first time we've seen women's hockey 3-on-3 was a couple weeks ago when the under-18 team took the U.S. played Canada in the final, and they played 3-on-3 and won in overtime. And so this coming World Championship, international rules have changed to 3-on-3 in overtime for women's hockey. So we actually haven't played 3-on-3 against each other. We're testing the market on a pretty big stage. And for me, obviously, speed's my game, and I'm super excited about it. I think we all are because, you know, this is the first time. So, you know, the fans are going to see it first.
You know, and this, Kendall, also is a prelude to maybe even a more serious competition, the rivalry series between the U.S. and Canada, right? You're going to play February 3rd in Victoria, February 5th in Vancouver, and February 8th in Anaheim. I think the games will be on the NHL Network. So we're talking about All-Star Weekend here, but this is in advance of another unique opportunity for people to really gravitate to the women's game and see these teams play in that rivalry series, right?
100%. So you can get a little taste of it 3-on-3, and then a few short weeks later, we'll be playing against each other again in those three games you mentioned. This is the second year in a row the rivalry series has taken place. Last year, we played in Toronto, London, Ontario, for the two games in Canada, and the last game was in Detroit in the U.S. So this is the second year in a row. The NHL is a big part of this rivalry series, and in women's hockey, we've been continuing to fight for more programming and to see the NHL step up and support these efforts. We're super excited, and you know, I hope people that watch us in St. Louis want to come back and watch us again, and then they have the opportunity to do so within those three games and also turn on the TV and watch them on NHL Network. So super, super exciting time for women's hockey.
Now, this is the second half of this year's rivalry series, right? Where does it stand going to the West Coast?
So the first two games, which are new to this year, were in Hartford and Moncton, and we won both of those games. So we'll see a different roster from those two games for each team than we will see at the rivalry series. So, again, it's awesome to see us grow the women's game and be able to showcase it on both sides of the country, for that matter.
You know, and before we move on to some current events in the NHL, which Sean and I do want to get to with you, but last year when you were in this fastest skater competition, I'm wondering, did you imagine when the league asked you to be a part of it, how big it would get for you and for the women's game, how it kind of went viral? Like, what has been the impact of that in the past year?
The impact's been tremendous, and I still think we're learning what the impact is today. You know, that moment was so successful. Here we are seeing 20 women participate a year later. We've seen more programming installed, you know, throughout, you know, the nation. There's 24 NHL organizations that have girls only program, and it used to be 6 last year. So we're continuing to see a lot of things change from that moment. But I think the most important part from that moment wasn't who skated. It wasn't how it was skated. It wasn't because Nathan MacKinnon got hurt. I mean, that's why it happened, but it wasn't, you know, that's not the storyline. It's all the women that deserve that event, that deserve that moment to skate on that platform. And that's something we're trying to create, is an important platform for women's hockey. And, you know, we see it every 4 years at the Olympic Games, but we still haven't found that platform to showcase it every day. So when the NHL said yes to that moment, there was a lot of people behind the scenes and a lot of players who worked and produced products for the NHL to say yes to that moment. And I happened to be there.
Just as importantly, who are you going to challenge to a match race this year?
Oh, well, I mean, I'm playing in the 3-on-3, so I won't be doing the fastest skater competition. So,
this will be off on the side. Nobody has to know about it.
I don't know. I mean, It would be fun to do it again. I will have to say that. But, you know, hopefully I'm skating north and south really fast and getting breakaways in 3-on-3.
Kendall, I know, and you do, let's get to some NHL stuff. You do part-time work with the Sharks on their broadcasts, and we can start right there. I mean, I think a lot of us were expecting more out of San Jose this year, didn't anticipate a coaching change there this season with the roster they had. What's your take on what has happened to the Sharks this season and why?
Yeah, it's been a tough season for the Sharks, and, you know, I think every guy in the room knows it's been tough. I think, you know, at the end of the day, you have to look at yourself in the mirror and say, how can I be better for this organization? But I think when you look at the offseason transactions that the Sharks had, losing Joe Pavelski, losing Jonas Donskoy, like, they lost a lot. And that's not a knock at Logan Couture's leadership abilities. You have Joe Thornton, you have Patrick Marleau. Logan Couture is an excellent leader, but there is a big hole, you know, left when in the locker room, you know, and in front. But with Joe Pavelski's departure, and I think, you know, having Patrick Marleau come back in was a huge boost. And, you know, that boost has worn off a little bit, but I think there have been moments where we've seen a team that can make a playoff run, and then we've seen teams that's at the bottom of the Pacific. And so it's, how do we get back to being consistent? How do we get back to every guy playing their best, you know, day in and day out, knowing it's a long season and you're not going to be your best every night and you're not going to win the same every night? However, this team, I think, is still searching for that identity, you know, through a coaching change. They're trying to find their starting goaltender. They're trying to find their starting center right now with Logan Couture, you know, going down, and, you know, the lines are jumbled a lot of nights. So I think, you know, it's been a tough season, but there's a lot of great character in that room, and it's got to come together at some point. Hopefully this break will refresh them, refuel them, and Logan will get healthy, you know, in the next few weeks.
So coming out of the All-Star break, it's less than a month to the trade deadline there. But what do you think San Jose is going to do? They're kind of in a weird position. Like you said, some nights they look like a team that can play in the Stanley Cup Finals. Other nights they look like a cellar dweller in the West. Doug's always been aggressive. Do you have a sense on what they should do or could do?
Yeah, it's tough because, you know, there's a large piece of the salary cap on the back end. But I don't see Doug Wilson giving up on this team at any point, at any moment. So I think he'll continue to be aggressive, and I would expect a transaction, you know, at the trade deadline for the Sharks. You know, the Barracuda have been having a tough year as well. So it's hard when you want to look down to the young guys and they're not performing to their best. So, you know, because of that, I would expect some type of shakeup for the Sharks come the trade deadline.
Big picture for you, Kendall, on the league in general. I'm curious, you know, we obviously are right at the break or approaching the All-Star break now. Teams are either on their 5-day break now or will be on it coming out of it. What do you see as a big storyline, other than the trade deadline, which we know is a big storyline, coming out of All-Star and getting really into the last few month grind here of the NHL season? What is catching your attention in the league right now?
Well, you know, I am a hometown girl, and, you know, I think people are sleeping on the Blackhawks.
Right.
They're on a 5-game win streak right now. You saw the reaction of that team when Patrick Kane got his 1,000th point, the entire bench celebrating with him on the ice. You know, I think that's a team that, you know, has the pedigree in the locker room. Of course, with Seabrook out, I think they're really rallying around, you know, whether he was a healthy scratch or he's getting 3 surgeries. There's a lot of leadership in that locker room. There's a pedigree that's still there. And, you know, I think it's a team that people have been sleeping on, but I think they're starting to find their identity and starting to play the way that they know they can play. We saw Jonathan Toews with a 4-point night the other night, and, you know, he looked like himself. So I think that's a team that, you know, people have put their, you know, 3 cups aside within the last decade, and, you know, they're a rebuild team, but I really don't think they are.
So nobody's sleeping on Alexander Ovechkin. He's got 8 goals in his last 3 games. He's closing in on 700. He's only 8 away. Who knows? He could do it in 2 games after the break with the way he's going. As an elite player yourself, when you look at Alex Ovechkin, what strikes you about him, and what, in your opinion, is the most dynamic thing about his game?
It's his passion. You watch when he scores a goal, it looks like he was the 3-year-old that just scored his first goal with a blue puck. It's amazing, his passion, and you can tell that that passion he has for scoring goals is something that everyone wants to feed off of. You know, he loves to win, he loves to score goals, and I was actually watching the other night thinking, you know, I don't recall watching Wayne Gretzky, you know, score many goals just in my time, and you know, watching him score the way he scores, I'm like, wow, it's pretty cool that I've been able to witness this at, you know, as a person who loves the game of hockey, because he's the most dynamic goal scorer I've seen in my time on this earth. So he's definitely fun to watch, and he just makes it look so easy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, he won't be in St. Louis, but you will be. So and we will be as well. So Kendall, we look forward to seeing you in St. Louis at the skills competition in 3-on-3 game. Thank you so much for doing this. All right.
Thank you so much.
We thank Kendall for jumping on with us. And Sean, she brought up Patrick Kane and the Blackhawks. And so let's talk about it. I mean, 1,000 points for Patrick Kane. He is the 90th player in NHL history to reach that mark. He's got 620 assists, 380 goals, 953 games. And interestingly enough, his parents, who were there for his entire career, and his dad especially is at United Center a lot, were not able to be in the stands for that game because of weather-related issues trying to get out of Buffalo to be there. And his dad was at the morning skate in advance of their game tonight, Tuesday, against the Florida Panthers, and he had a big sign up that said 1,000 points in the stands. So they're into it.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. You hear the stories about when Patrick was younger, them all piling in the car and driving all over creation for youth hockey tournaments. And then even in the NHL, he's one of the most attached dads I think there is. So proud of Patrick. So that was an unfortunate part of it. But, you know, I think he's still got a lot of points left, right? We're talking about a player who's actually, you could argue, is hitting his prime. Last year was his best year yet, and he hasn't fallen off much this year.
Is he the best U.S.-born player in NHL history, in your estimation?
I'm going to hedge a little here. He, to me, is the best American-born forward out of a very elite group.
Okay.
I'm not convinced he's better than Brian Leetch yet.
Okay. Why?
Because to me, Brian Leetch was different from every other American defenseman that's played the game. To me, he was the American Bobby Orr.
I'd argue that Patrick Kane's been different than just about every other American forward, too, because of the hands, the skill, the winning, the clutch. I think he's the best U.S.-born player of all time, with due respect to Brian Leetch, no question.
We worked with a guy for several years here who was pretty good in Patty LaFontaine.
Yep.
And you just described, to me, you just described JR.
Yeah, but he never won, which I think counts for something, and Kane's going to have better numbers than him. So, I understand what you're saying about Jeremy Roenick, but he also was not at an elite level for as long as Patrick Kane. And I mean, but Mike Modano was obviously in the discussion too.
Of course, but he was a similar player.
Yeah, yeah. No.
Whereas I don't think you can name another American that even approaches what Leetch did just stylistically. Maybe John Carlson now, if he's as good for as long, but Leetch got there faster. He won in New York, which hadn't happened, and he was just the most dominant. He's the most dominant defenseman I've seen in my lifetime.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, he was obviously a terrific player. I'm not going to take it. It's like we're, you know, I'm not going to argue against Brian Leetch being a great player. I just look at Patrick Kane and I think to myself, when the Blackhawks have needed a big moment, he's been a part of it, and they've had a lot of those moments. The skill, the hands. You know, he's just been lights out. And like you said, he might even be getting better at this stage of his career, which is remarkable when you consider how many games he's played, being 47, almost 40, you know, play tonight, being 46 away from 1,000. And he might even be getting better. It's remarkable.
When it's over, he's going to be the best.
Okay. So, but you don't say it. Not right now. All right. Let me ask you this question before we wrap it up. We've got All-Star Weekend coming up in St. Louis. What is your favorite All-Star game setup? And by that, I mean we've got the 3-on-3 in the All-Star game. We've had North America versus the world. We've had the teams drafting, you know, the captains drafting their teams. And obviously the old Campbell-Wales or East-West formats. What's your favorite?
A new one. Here's what I propose.
Oh, we haven't even seen it yet.
Never seen it.
Okay.
You pick the two players in the All-Star game that don't get along the most. And you have them pick the teams. No captains. So this year,
Tkachuk and Leon Draisaitl.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, Sean. Since we don't have that, I want to see Rick Tocchet, who is now the coach of the Pacific Division because Gerard Gallant, who was going to be the coach, got fired from Vegas. So Rick Tocchet's going to be there representing the Arizona Coyotes. And I want to see him put Leon Draisaitl and Matthew Tkachuk out there together to start the game, the first game the Pacific Division plays, and let's see what happens. Because Leon Draisaitl said he would skate off the ice if that were the case.
That would be awesome.
Quickest
line change in the history of the All-Star. Usually you're yelling at guys because they're staying out there too long.
Yeah, these guys want to stay out there, hang out there.
Change.
Yep, he's gone. I would love to see. I mean, we'd all be talking about it. It would be a great lead-in to the second half of the season, especially when the Flames play. And the Oilers play on January 29th. It would be terrific. Let's see it happen.
They play back-to-back coming out of the break.
That's going to be great. So back to the original question. I like the North America versus the world format. We had it for 5 years. I like it. And I think, you know, and there was something coming out of Board of Governors last month about the potential for an international flavored All-Star game next year. And maybe it'll be a 3-on-3 tournament. You know, maybe you'll have 6 countries, the U.S., Canada, Russia, Sweden, Finland, and the Czech. And then 2 European conglomerate teams, so to speak, where you have some, you know, some guys there and they play. They got 8 teams. I'm just spitballing here. I know you're nobody can see it, but he's disagreeing with me visually. He's looking at me and look like I'm an idiot right now.
Well, first of all, forget the European conglomerates. If you're going to steal the World Cup idea from 2016,
which is exactly what it is,
let's take a Young Guns team say one captain can only pick guys under 25. But why don't we do it this way? Again, you pick the 6 countries, and you let them pick whoever they want. It doesn't have to be along country lines. More than likely, they will.
Yeah.
But you can raid the other guy, and you'd have 6 teams, but the captains would each represent their country. You could still call them that country.
I think these guys, if they given an opportunity, they could play for their country. You throw a USA jersey or Canada jersey, Russia jersey on them, and you play in an All-Star. It might make the All-Star game. Like we talked to Kendall Coyne Schofield about the 3-on-3 with Canada and the U.S., and that could be the most serious event of All-Star weekend. This would make for an interesting All-Star weekend. Make it a little more competitive, I think.
Maybe. I think the talent pool might be a little thin at that point.
Maybe. Well, anyway, it's an idea.
It's a good idea,
though,
Dan.
Idea, and we potentially could have an international-flavored All-Star game next year. We don't this year. We have the 3-on-3, and we're both very much looking forward to getting to St. Louis.
It's been a great – people forget that it wasn't this way for a long time, and it was changed to make it competitive. The million-dollar prize pool was brought in to – help motivate people,
and
game has been so much better.
It's worked.
It's enjoyable.
Absolutely,
to watch.
It's enjoyable to watch. Guys are into it, especially in that championship game. They're very much into it, and I like the 3-on-3 setup. I was partial to the North America versus the world. I just thought that was a cool little thing that the NHL did at the time, really to promote the Olympics.
If they bring it back, they got to bring back the uniforms. Remember those green and purple ones?
Yes.
But here's the other thing: you want a little nuance, a little new thing.
Sure.
New skills competition.
Yeah.
The dude perfect, shoot it from the concourse onto the ice.
My son's looking forward to that one.
Everybody's son is looking forward to that
one.
I
can't wait for that.
Those guys are unbelievable in what they come up with. And a lot of guys have already done it. Malkin and Crosby have done it. The guys in the Stars did it because that's where the dude perfect guys are from. They've done, if you ever look on YouTube, they've done all kinds of crazy trick shots hockey-wise. But that's going to be a ton of fun watching guys launch pucks from the upper concourse and try and score into small nets on the ice.
And I think I saw somebody was saying that they ran sort of a rehearsal on that to see how it would look with some of the former players now work for the NHL, and everybody wanted a part of it. Everybody wanted, when they were deciding, could we do this? Everybody wanted a part of it. So I think you're going to get a lot of player participation in that. They're going to want to do that event.
And there's going to be some style.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
some personality.
Can't wait.
Absolutely. Some personality. And you know what? This is not going to be our last show of the week. We have another one. We are going to be doing a show from St. Louis. So that'll be interesting, too. That'll be a lot of fun. We'll get some guests on. We'll have a good time in St. Louis. We'll probably try to record it Friday morning in advance of the skills, in advance of the game. I'm looking forward to that, too.
I believe they call that a twofer in the radio business now we're part of.
We are the podcast business.
It's the same family.
Similar. There are still a couple of games to go before we do get to St. Louis, so everybody enjoy them. And then, of course, enjoy All-Star Weekend. Thank you so much, Sean. This is another great episode, I think, and I can't wait to sit back down with you again at St. Louis.
after we have some toasted ravioli and some barbecue first.
Absolutely, Sean. That's a must when you get to St. Louis. What's also a must is we need your feedback. So don't forget, rate and review this podcast. Let us know how we're doing. A couple of games left. We'll be in St. Louis soon, recording from Friday. Until then, enjoy the games, everybody.